This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. So glad to have your company on this lovely Sunday. Stay tuned. We've got stories about the newest state park in Virginia and the darker side of one of America's most popular national parks. Also, a look at the 5th District Congressional race, where there's an open seat up for grabs for the area covering Charlottesville and areas east of the Blue Ridge. We'll also hear my conversation with the Democratic challenger in the 6th District, Kai Degner. And our Island Universe is coming up, too. But first, a week ago Saturday, Natural Bridge became the 37th Virginia State Park. The ceremony followed a journey involving a tourist attraction under disrepair, troubled finances, and a monument with deep roots in Virginia's history. WMRA's Jesse Nadler was at the ceremony and has this report.
Crowds of people gathered at the 215-foot-high limestone arch in Rockbridge County on Saturday to celebrate the site's official transition to a state park. Governor Terry McAuliffe was on hand to mark the occasion.
I want to now formally declare that Natural Bridge is now Virginia's 37th state park.
Affiliation with the Park Service is expected to increase visitation while forever protecting the geological formation and its 1,500 surrounding acres from development. The celebration concludes a tense couple of years for healthcare executive Tom Clark, who spearheaded the project.
You think about Thomas Jefferson, and he wrote in 1815, his great concern was the Natural Bridge would be defaced and we wouldn't have access to the public. So really today, we're fulfilling Thomas Jefferson's dream. It seemed like a simple task. I mean, how in the world in America today would we allow Natural Bridge to go to the auction block to irreversibly be changed?
In 2014, Clark worked out a complex deal that enabled his nonprofit company, the Virginia Conservation Legacy Fund, or VCLF, to buy the then privately owned attraction using a $9.1 million loan from the Virginia Resources Authority. Once the loan was to be paid off in 10 years, the VCLF would donate the Natural Bridge to the Commonwealth for use as a state park.
We really didn't know a lot, so we sort of took the risk naively jumping into it. I've been asked many times, Tom, you've defaulted on this loan. Do you think you did all the due diligence you needed? And my response is always, oh, goodness, no. If we'd done all the due diligence, we never would have jumped into the deal.
The project was just so much bigger than we even imagined.
Jennifer Bell is the COO of the VCLF and part of the management team that made the deal happen. The hotel was in terrible repair. Visitation was way down. A construction company filed a lien against the hotel. State officials stepped in after the VCLF were unable to make loan payments to the state. Jennifer wondered if the VCLF was in over its head.
Yes. Probably the first 2 years we were doing this, I thought that every morning. Since that time, though, working with the folks at DCR to make the state park happen, it's just been on an upward trend, and this is a great day.
On September 13th, the Virginia Resources Authority finally approved a 10-year extension on the $9.1 million loan. The VCLF now has 20 years to pay it off, cutting annual loan payments down to almost half. Under a unique agreement, the VCLF will continue to own the property until the debt is paid. But the park will be managed by the Virginia Department of Conservation and Recreation. Here's DCR Director Clyde Christman speaking at the event.
And I got to tell you, Governor, this is the riskiest thing that we have ever done in opening a state park on property that we don't own.
The DCR is much better equipped to manage the park than the VCLF. More experience, better marketing infrastructure. Ticket prices were slashed from $20 to $8 per adult.
If you pulled off the interstate with a family of four and found out it was going to cost you $80 to come in here, a lot of people probably just got back in their car and went on somewhere else.
Annual revenue is expected to grow from $2.3 million in 2017 to $3.1 million in 2021. More visitors to the area are expected to pump $4.5 million into Rockbridge County's economy. One attraction that isn't going anywhere is the 89-year-old Drama of Creation, a biblical-themed outdoor sound and light show. Because of the separation of church and state, it can't be shown during business hours, but remains popular, so will be shown after hours for donations, courtesy of the VCLF. For WMRA News, I'm Jesse Nadler.
from Virginia's newest state park to one of our favorite national parks. Since it opened in 1936, Shenandoah National Park has welcomed an average of well over 1.5 million visitors each year. Many of them may not know of the park's painful past. One avid hiker who researched and wrote about that past calls her book A Broken-Hearted Love Song to the Park, as WMRA's Christopher Clymer-Kurtz reports.
I'm a hiker. I love the park, but I'm devastated about what happened. How can I live with myself being a hiker in that park?
Northern Virginia resident and writer Sue Eisenfeld says her 2015 book, titled Shenandoah, A Story of Conservation and Betrayal, actually tells three stories: how Virginia and the federal government created Shenandoah National Park, what happened to the people who had been living there, and her own journey of discovery and understanding.
In some ways, I really was looking for grace because I want to keep hiking there. It can't be all bad. And it isn't all bad. It's this beautiful, preserved place that millions of people enjoy every year.
Eisenfeld spoke last week to a crowded room at James Madison University, a guest of Special Collections, which houses some of the documents Eisenfeld used in her research. Already there were many books about the park, but as an avid hiker there for years, she came across many artifacts like pottery shards, farm equipment, engines, wagon wheels, and more. She felt she had to make sense of the history for herself.
If we had to create this park by throwing out thousands of people and dispossessing them, what kind of people do that? And what kind of people do that in the way it was done, i.e. handcuffing people, physically dragging them away, burning down their homes? This actually happened to some people in the park. You know, others took the money that they were paid and left, and some were okay with it. Some were happy to move into the lowlands, so I don't want to say that everyone was dispossessed, but what kind of people did this?
To research, Eisenfeld hiked to cemeteries, old foundations of homes and barns, orchards. She interviewed descendants of park residents, studied maps, deeds, National Park Service records. One force behind the creation of the park was William Carson, who Eisenfeld calls a big guy in Virginia history. Eisenfeld felt she had to get to know this man, whose work to create something so beautiful caused so many people so much pain.
For me, the complete turning point of the writing of the book happened because I found one sheet of paper. It was one letter that kind of changed everything for me in terms of William Carson.
She explains that letter and its effect on her in her book. Eisenfeld's research also led her to JMU's Special Collections interviews with former residents, like this one from 1978, in which Maddie Yeager talks about her father.
My daddy danced all night long, every dance that come up. He was a powerful dancer right up till he died, and he was 80 years old. He danced the dance and didn't worry you out. So a flat to the floor dance. He didn't go up high. You see, I had a brother.
Virginia Taylor was among those in the audience at Eisenfeld's book talk. Afterwards, she said her grandfather, Glenn, then age 17, was among those evicted from park land in 1936.
He always had a pretty surly attitude about what happened.
She said his family had farmed the land there for about 200 years. That sense of longevity helped draw Eisenfeld into the park's story.
This was my first exposure to people who had been here for generations, who had fought in the Revolution, War of 1812, Civil War. And I guess I had just never known a lot of people who had been here that long. And I really came to feel attached to them and felt like I cared about their families as if they were my own.
Eisenfeld said that for many descendants of the park's former residents, especially those that still live nearby, the pain of the loss continues.
It has not diminished for them. They feel raw emotion, as if it happened yesterday and not 80 years ago.
The government's use of its power of eminent domain in the establishment of national parks is not unique to the history of the Shenandoah National Park. It has played a role in the formation or expansion of Rock Creek, Mammoth Cave, Great Smoky Mountains, and Everglades National Parks, as well as Big Cypress National Preserve, the Redwood National Forest, and more. For author Sue Eisenfeld, researching and writing about the Shenandoah National Park's painful past led her to the grace she was looking for as a hiker on sacred ground.
I was looking for a way that I could feel like it was okay to be here. And both from my research and also just meeting people, I felt like they were saying to me, it's okay to be here.
For WMRA News, I'm Christopher Clymer-Kurtz.
And if you would like to do a little historical research of your own, you can do so through some of the links we've provided at WMRA.org. Democrats need to win 30 seats to regain control of the U.S. House, and to do that, they must record some upsets on November the 8th. That could happen in Virginia's 5th Congressional District. Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Houseman reports on why the pundits are watching this year's contest.
Democrat Jane Dittmar got a nice surprise last week when the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee announced it was adding her to its red-to-blue list of candidates who might win in Republican districts. Kyle Condick at UVA's Center for Politics says both major parties like to highlight such races.
I think particularly they like to give some attention to those candidates as a way of telling national donors that maybe they should consider contributing to a particular race. Virginia's 5th Congressional District is one that certainly leans to the Republicans at the presidential level, but Democrats maybe have seen enough from Jane Dittmar to want to highlight that district as one that they might have a chance at pulling an upset in.
Condick doubts Democrats will win enough seats to control the House of Representatives, but he thinks the Senate is up for grabs.
Maybe a few weeks ago, one would have thought that the Democrats would be more of a favorite to win the Senate. The race for the Senate looks very close right now and competitive.
As part of the Red to Blue program, Jane Dittmar is expected to get some financial, communications, grassroots, and strategic support from the National Democratic Party. Her opponent is State Senator Tom Garrett, a conservative Republican. I'm Sandy Houseman.
Well, last week, WMRA began our series of interviews with candidates for the two congressional races in our region of Virginia. Those races are for the 5th District, which we just heard about, and for the 6th District, which covers much of western Virginia from Lynchburg and Roanoke through the Shenandoah Valley to Front Royal. Democrat Kai Degner is challenging longtime incumbent Republican Bob Goodlatte. Degner is a former mayor of Harrisonburg, and he's finishing up his most recent term as city councilman. He's also a local real estate agent. He's active in many local boards and causes. And full disclosure, he has also served on WMRA's Independent Advisory Council. He sat down with me last week to talk about his campaign, and I asked him about his opposition to the proposed Atlantic Coast Natural Gas Pipeline, which some Democrats, including Governor Terry McAuliffe, and even some in the path of the pipeline, support.
People have a myth out there that it's going to provide a lot of energy and jobs. The fact is it's not slated to provide a lot of jobs for the area once it's complete. The construction jobs are actually mainly transient workers that'll just be here for the time period of building the pipeline. We have farmers and veterans and families that own land that's going to be taken by this pipeline, whether they want it or not. Mr. Goodlatte has streamlined that review process, which I don't agree with. And I think it's a good example of where big government is impacting people's lives to the detriment of families and landowners.
As the challenger in a political campaign, your role, as in any such campaign where you're challenging the incumbent, is to go after his record. But what affirmative case are you making for running as a candidate for the 6th District seat? What do you see as your role in Congress, and what issues motivate you the most?
Well, I think you can do both. I think you can tell the truth about his record and make a distinction between what I am going to be doing when I'm in Congress. First of all, we talked about him streamlining the pipeline review process. I don't agree with that. He voted to fast-track the TPP. I'm against the TPP, mainly because it gives up our national sovereignty to this investor-state dispute resolution tribunal, which I don't agree with. Mr. Goodlatte has blocked immigration reform. I think we need immigration reform urgently. He stopped it in his committee after the full Senate had already approved it. I'm also a big believer in cannabis reform. I think we should deschedule cannabis for a number of reasons. I believe in the health benefits of marijuana and cannabis and hemp. I don't believe that opioids are the solution to these things. And obviously, the criminalization of marijuana is putting disproportionately poor and minority folks in jail. And then obviously, a big conversation here is about gun violence. Mr. Goodlatte is the number one recipient in Congress in the continental United States of money received from the NRA. And I don't think that lets you have an honest conversation with the majority of Americans who believe that while we have rights to guns, we ought to have background checks and other sensible gun laws.
Looking at the 6th District as a whole, it's a pretty conservative district.
Sure.
You mentioned the gun issue. There are a lot of people in the district who support gun rights, many of whom are NRA members. They respond to other issues that Republicans talk about. What are you hearing from those more conservative voters, and what do you tell them?
When I think of conservative, I think of someone trying to be thoughtful and to look at the issues and really explore them thoughtfully. And I think that is being lost when Mr. Goodlatte gets 76% of his money from out of the district and 60% of it from political action committees and basically just trumpets the party line. It doesn't allow for a real review and a thoughtfulness when you review policy. You're really just repeating talking points. On the gun issue, of course, I believe that people have the right, the constitutional right, to guns. And the data shows that the majority of Americans believe people that have mental illness problems shouldn't have guns. People believe that the Dickey Amendment ought to be repealed. The Dickey Amendment keeps us from studying things like the fact that the leading cause of white males dying between the ages of 20 and 30 is suicide by gun. That can't be studied because of the Dickey Amendment, which Mr. Goodlatte keeps in place.
And that's that keeps organizations like the Centers for Disease Control from and other government agencies from actually studying the issue.
That's correct.
Okay. With frustrations with inaction in Congress and public approval of Congress hovering at around 12% in one recent poll, are there any issues that you can see coming to agreement on with Republicans should you win the election? How do you see bridging that divide in such a polarized institution, and how does your experience on Harrisonburg City Council weigh into that?
Congress is set up for a debate. That's what the founding fathers had in mind. The idea is that we have a healthy exchange of ideas, and it's through that debate that we're supposed to have better decisions come out. I wouldn't want five Kai Degners on Harrisonburg City Council. I'm glad that we have a range of opinion, and I think we make better decisions for it. But what I don't see happening on City Council, that I do see happening in Congress, is people shutting down the debate and not even allowing discussions to happen. I think a great example of where we could agree is unleashing the hemp economy. If we deschedule cannabis, we can create a hemp economy that would allow farms and agricultural industries here in the 6th District in particular, but all across the country, create a crop that could be the most profitable crop, 10 times more profitable than corn. We can make 25,000 different products out of it, and it can create jobs all over the country.
Some people might say that party affiliation aside, the advantage of having a representative in Congress for more than 20 years is the seniority, maybe the greater influence, the committee assignments, and so on. And Mr. Goodlatte now chairs the House Judiciary Committee. How would you answer that concern as a freshman member of Congress if elected?
Well, maybe I'd answer it the same way that Mr. Goodlatte was answering it when he campaigned in 1992 and said that he'd only be in office for 12 years. He's now working on his 25th and 26th year and has forgotten the concerns that he must have had in 1992, that once you become so entrenched and become so establishment, you can't really think like the average person in your district anymore. Once you become a millionaire and once you've been in Congress for over two decades, I just think you lose touch with the families that are working paycheck to paycheck, and you lose a sense of urgency that the problems of healthcare affordability and jobs and income and retirement security, those need to be solved yesterday. You can't assign these to more study groups and fix it in 6 or 10 years. People want action, and to create action, you have to make agreements. And the Republican establishment has been avoiding making agreements for 8 years now. I'm hearing from a lot of people that are frustrated with a Congress that's broken. The biggest challenge is to communicate with a district, I think the size of Connecticut, in 5 months. So I'm new to the race. I wasn't expecting to run. And I need to introduce myself as a small business owner and a real estate agent and someone that's been in local government for 8 years. So people seem real receptive to someone out there working hard and listening to them.
Kai Degner, thanks for taking the time with us today.
My pleasure.
We expect to talk with the man Mr. Degner is challenging, Republican Bob Goodlatte, in October. The two candidates have one debate scheduled in Lynchburg on October 17th, and we'll also be hearing from the two candidates for the 5th District seat in the next few days.
I'm Chanel Varani, and this is Our Island Universe. In less than a year, gravitational waves have gone from being an obscure theoretical prediction of Albert Einstein's theory of gravity to a new window through which we can examine the cosmos. The first detection of gravity waves, announced in February 2016, told astronomers that two black holes, one weighing 36 times the mass of the Sun and the other 29 times the mass of our Sun, inspiraled and collided to form a new black hole that weighs 62 times the mass of our Sun. The waves given off by the merger of two black holes reached Earth as a tiny ripple in space-time that changed the length of a 4-kilometer instrument by 1/1000th the width of a proton. Just 4 months later, the same team announced the discovery of a second detection. In this case, two black holes weighing 7 and 14 times the mass of the Sun collided to produce a black hole that weighs 20 times the mass of the Sun. Where did some of the other mass go? It went into producing energy from the collision, a tiny bit which reached Earth and told us about the cataclysmic event. Two observations in a short amount of time tell us that there may be a large population of binary black holes that frequently merge. Get ready for results like this to become routine. But the physics that produced the signal is anything but. I am Chanel Varani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium at James Madison University.
Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Les and Johnny Grady, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of the Community Foundation of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. If you'd like to learn more about how we fund our news and how you can help, go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. Find all of our stories from the newsroom at WMRA.org, and be sure to click like on Facebook at WMRA Public Radio. And follow me on Twitter at WMRA News to get the latest on our coverage. And as we head into the final hours of our fall More News, Less Noise Fund Drive, please don't forget to give at WMRA.org. It'll end tomorrow night or sooner if we meet our $190,000 goal, whichever comes first. We're not interrupting anything for the fund drive, but this style of raising money only works if you participate. Give a little, give a lot, but please let us hear from you at WMRA.org. Thanks. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director and morning edition host. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday. And we leave you with the Shenandoah Valley Children's Choir singing Shenandoah from the Shenandoah National Park. That was recorded back in June. And it was posted on the Shenandoah National Park Facebook page, where you can see the video. It's gone viral, almost 200,000 hits so far.